Good morning. Before we get started in the book of Mark this morning, I'd just like a brief show of hands here. How many of you are planning on being here during the second service also? Is there some people? There is a few. You guys are causing me no end of anxiety, you know, because this will be the first time I've ever had to preach the same sermon twice in a row. In fact, I've never ever preached the same sermon twice. So some of you guys will have to let me know how I do after the second service. Let's turn in the book of Mark for a few moments. And Mark has a special place in the Bible for me. Because as I began to read the Bible, and you know, you start in Genesis because that's the beginning and you keep going and you get through to the end. Mark is where I began to realize who Jesus really is. It was the book of Mark. Mark is so direct. He doesn't waste any words. It's all right there. And what you need to know, he tells you. I love this chapter and the one preceding it too, because you learn who Jesus is. The chapter that Pastor Alvin dealt with last week, at the end, we see Jesus in a boat, crossing with his disciples the lake, and he calms the storm. He demonstrates power over nature. In this chapter we're looking at today, and that's not what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about the demonic from Gadara. But in this chapter today, he demonstrates, in the first 20 verses, power over the spirit world. Then he demonstrates power over disease. And last of all, he raises somebody from the dead. He demonstrates power over death. That was pretty hard hitting for me because people don't do that. You know, I grew up with the idea that there was no God and Jesus was just some kind of a good teacher. And I had some awful teachers, and a couple of pretty good ones too. But they didn't even have power over me, let alone nature and the spirit world and all those other things. I've since learned that there is some really good teachers out there. My grandchildren would come home from school and tell me that they had some really good teachers. But those guys didn't have that much power either. But Jesus did. I learned from this passage, he was more than just a man, more than just a human being. Those are all attributes of divinity. We can't control anything, but Jesus is God, and he has the power to control all of it. Let's take a look for a few moments at one of my favorite and life-changing... Oh, I just knocked the foot off this thing here. Oh, well, who cares? I probably won't spend much time standing in front of it anyway. This passage here we're looking at today, Mark chapter 1, or chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, the demonic from Gadara. This was life-changing and life-directing. For me, what we're looking for in life, all of us, whether we realize it or not, is deliverance. Deliverance from the things that bind us, the things that chain us, the things that drag us down, the things that we're ashamed of, the things that cause us to fail at life. And here we find someone who has the power to deliver us. They're in a boat. They come across the Sea of Galilee. It says, when they came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes, and when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. Now, we don't put much stock in our society in demon possession. We tend to look at it as, it must have been mentally ill or something, and they just didn't understand. Mental illness and demon possession have nothing to do with each other. Demon possession is not a treatable illness. This guy wasn't sick. He was possessed. We don't give the ancients enough credit for knowing things. If Jesus Christ can live in us by the power of his Spirit, it follows also that the powers of hell can also do that. And there's other parts of the world where they understand that much better than we do. So this man really was demon-possessed. He wasn't just sick. He didn't need some medication or some psychiatric help. Those things would have done him absolutely no good. It says he lived among the tombs and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Even when they did get this guy bound up, they couldn't keep him that way. We read in the paper sometimes where it takes four policemen to subdue somebody who is maybe crazed with drugs or something. And the writer in the newspaper will mark out, this guy had superhuman strength because of the drugs that were in him. No, he didn't. He was just insensitive to pain because of the drugs that were in him. And the four guys that it took to subdue him, the reason it took four guys is because they had some consideration for his life and safety, and he had none for theirs. So he didn't have superhuman strength. Once they got the cuffs on him, that's it. Into the car he goes, tame as a lamb. The policeman will even hold the top of his head to keep him from bumping it when he goes. And I've watched these things a few times. And it's not superhuman strength, because once the cuffs are on, they're not ripping the chains apart from the handcuffs, and they're just little itty-bitty chains. They're not even that big. It wasn't as if they had to use a piece of 3/8 spinning chain from an oil rig on him, which is really strong. I was impressed with that stuff. My first job was on an oil rig in a place called Zama City in northern Alberta, and I was so impressed with spinning chain because it was so light and thin, and yet it was so amazingly strong. They didn't have to use that on this guy. Well, they couldn't use it on him. It says he wrenched the chains apart, and once again, the ancients knew how to make chains and shackles. They were great blacksmiths. When they didn't just put handcuffs on somebody, he got a custom-made set of shackles for his wrists or his arms, and they were riveted on with a hot rivet and bound by chain, which might not have looked quite as technologically perfect as spinning chain, but it was strong. They were good blacksmiths. They knew probably more about metallurgy than perhaps most of us do today. He'd often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart. He broke the shackles in pieces. This is just not your ordinary run-of-the-mill drug addict or whatever who's gone off the deep end, or somebody who's exceptionally strong. Chain up an Olympic weightlifter. Is he going to break them chains? Not a chance. This guy broke them apart, ripped the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Even if they got him down long enough to chain him up, they couldn't keep him there. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. That's the thing about Satan. The Bible says he comes to kill and destroy and hurt. if nobody else was hurting this guy or beating him or trying to subdue him, he was hurting himself. So often in our own lives, that's what we're doing too. We may not be demon-possessed, but because of sin in us and in the world, we're our own worst enemy many times. It says, when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran. He fell down before him. Crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For Jesus was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." It's kind of interesting. Jesus is having a conversation with the demons that are possessing this guy. And you have to think that if they had control, absolute control, this guy'd be running the other way, right? He'd want to get as far away from Jesus as he could. But even possessed by these demons, those legs moved him toward Jesus. There was something inside him. He knew what he needed. He knew what he wanted. He wanted to be delivered of whatever it was that was in him and however it got there. And we can speculate about that, but the Bible doesn't tell us. But he needed deliverance, and he knew it. Just as we as human beings, all of us, prior to Christ, we need deliverance. Whether it's from demons, whether it's from a chemical or alcohol addiction, whether it's just some rotten aspects of our own personalities and ways of doing things. There's all kinds of reasons why we're the way we are. But we need to be changed. And this man recognized it. And where did he go? He came to Jesus. The interesting thing, too, is Jesus actually came to him first, right? Jesus shows up on the lakeshore, right in front of him. And I can't think that that was an accident. Just like Zacchaeus up in the tree. Jesus knew he was there. He says, "Come on down. We're going to your house for lunch." I'm sure that Jesus came knowing he would meet this man, knowing that this poor, pitiful soul would come to him for deliverance. I know what that's like too, because I came to Jesus myself once for that very thing. Jesus asked him in verse 9, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." That isn't a man talking, is it? That's a whole group of demons possess this man. It's interesting. In time of crisis, a Roman legion had about 5,000 people in it. During lesser times, when they were occupying some place that had already been conquered or just doing a little police action somewhere, a legion might only have 1,000, maybe 2,000 men. They were much smaller. The sizes were variable. We don't know how many were in this group, in this legion. But he says, "We're many." And he, this is the demons, begged him, that's Jesus, earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs. Let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. This man had all these demons inside him. He was living with this. And these poor pigs, they got about one apiece, as far as we can tell. And they couldn't stand it at all. Into the sea. It was kind of interesting. I thought, Jesus, a guy, I hate to tell you folks this, he was an old Mennonite guy. If any of you are Mennonite, it's no reflection on you because I know you don't think this way. But this old guy told me once that Jesus never laughed or smiled. But I think Jesus had a sense of humor because he, to the Jews, a pig was an unclean animal. So where did he send the unclean spirits? Right into them poor pigs. And even though they're an unclean animal, I like pork, and they didn't deserve it. But Jesus had a sense of humor. Don't kid yourself. The herdsmen fled. They told it in the city and in the country. And people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus. They saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. They were afraid before. They were afraid of the guy before, and now they were still afraid. How come? It's kind of like, well, I'll tell you a story about my brothers and my brother and my sisters and my mom and dad. I came to Christ at the age of about 26. I was from a home where we didn't believe that God existed. We were just some lucky cosmic accident. And when I went home to tell them about it, they were afraid. They didn't act afraid. They acted angry. They acted disgusted. They acted all kinds of things. And it really put a gap between us, which is, to some extent, has been healed, but is still there. They knew how to take me before with all my faults, my many faults. But once God began to address those things, they had no idea what to do with me, and they were afraid. I was just lucky that my wife came before me, because if I'd come first, she'd have been afraid too. And who knows what happened. I knew a guy, a couple named Abe and Sarah. And, no, Susan, pardon me, it was Susan. Abe and Susan. And Abe was a terrible drunk, and Susan complained about it constantly. She'd tell anybody that listened how badly he treated her, and every time he hit her, and every time he took a drink, and all that sort of thing. But one day, Abe decided he was going to quit. And I don't know why he did that. I don't think it was a particularly religious experience or anything, but he was going to quit drinking, and he did. She lasted 2 months, and she was gone. She didn't know what to do with him after that. She knew how to live with him when he was a drunk, but she had no idea how to live with him when he was sober, when he wasn't a drunk anymore. And I think that's what happened to these people. They came along, and here's this guy. Well, we're used to him, you know. We hear him coming. You find some place you should have been half an hour ago, and you go there to get out. You get out of the way. But now, here he is sitting. He's got clothes on. He's in his right mind. He's making sense. He's not raging and foaming at the mouth. And they were afraid. They knew how to live with him the way he was before, but they had no idea now. And that happens to us too. Those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. That's why some people never come to Jesus. They might have an encounter with him, but they don't come to him because they want things to stay the way that they have always been. Sure, life is not perfect, But you know what? I'm really enjoying it, and it's going pretty good for me right now. And even if it's not, well, you know what? If it changes, it could be worse. So they don't come because they don't want to. I know that because for a while I was in that boat. I began to read the Bible at 23, but it was just before my 26th birthday, before I actually came to Jesus. I didn't want things to change. I was scared of what would happen to my life if I changed. If I decided to follow Jesus, how would things be? I had no idea. And I was afraid. And I think these people were too. Go away, Jesus, because we like things the way they are. They might not be so good, but you could make it worse, you know. I might have to give up dancing or something. That was my father's. He told me one time, he said, I can't follow Jesus like you because then your mom and I wouldn't be able to go to a dance on Saturday night. They went dancing every Saturday night, a couple of times during the week too. And they loved it, and they were good dancers. And I didn't think they would have to quit. Some of you might think they might have had to quit, but I don't really think so. I've never been a dancer because I'm not good at it, but they were really smooth. And my dad said, you know, we'd have to quit dancing. And that was his reason. He didn't want to change. He was afraid of what changes might come to his life. So they asked Jesus to leave. It says, as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with the demons begged him that he might be with him. But he did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. That was a powerful bit of scripture for me personally. And I'm not saying it will be for you, but it certainly was to me, because when I came to Jesus, I told him I would do anything he wanted me to do. And I had ideas about what that might be. I thought it might be going to some far country and trying to tell people about Jesus. And I never did make it, but my daughter made it instead. Her husband dragged her off to some rat hole of the world, and there they are. But I thought it might be that. It might be other things. But I could never get past this, because I was raised in a town, near a town that had no gospel preaching church, by people who didn't know Jesus, surrounded by family and neighbors who didn't know Jesus either. And besides, I always wanted to be a farmer. You know, my life's ambition was to pop around a field on a two-cylinder John Deere tractor. But you know what? I never made that either. We went back. I promised my wife that we'd go back just for a couple of years, just to tell everybody what had happened to us, and then we'd get on with life. And she was okay with that. If I told her it was going to be for 30-odd, I don't know if she'd have gone. I might have had to go by myself. But we went back, because it isn't always great things and faraway things and unusual things that God calls us to. Sometimes those things are pretty plain and pretty ordinary. And this man wanted to go with Jesus and see and do and experience the great things. But where did Jesus have it marked out for him? Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. Actually, God sent him home to do the hardest thing. Jesus himself said, not much is going to happen here in Nazareth. You know, Jesus was raised there. So couldn't do any great works there. It was the hardest place to go and to be. Go home to your friends. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he's had mercy on you. And I love this guy. It says he went away and he began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. The Decapolis, that word means the 10 cities. And they might not have been very big cities. Maybe some of them were the size of Three Hills. Maybe some of them were the size of the town I was raised in. There certainly would have been no place that was as big as Calgary, and maybe not even Red Deer. Probably not. There were just little places, and there was 10 of them. You know, he might have been in an area of 4,000 or 5,000 people. But I love the fact he didn't just go home to tell the friends and family. He went home and he told everybody as far around as he could walk. He went away. He began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. Doesn't say they all believed. But he got to tell them anyway. I love that part of the story. And that's our job too. We're not responsible for the results. We're not out there for professional success or the adulation of crowds of people or anything like that. We're out there just like this man to be obedient to our wonderful Lord and Savior and be obedient as we can be. He wasn't content just with a little bit of obedience. He had to have it all. So away he went. Now you and I would have probably preferred to be with Jesus too. That might have been easier, we hope. But the best thing is not what we hope for, not what we think we would like. The best thing, the absolute best thing, is what does Jesus want from my life? And we don't need to worry too much about whether we make a mistake when we're deciding that either. Because following Christ, our Christ, is a self-correcting, it's like a GPS, you know. You make a mistake, you take a wrong turn in the road, and what does it say? Turn left at the next intersection. Make a U-turn. GPSs are wonderful things. Way better than a road map, because I can't read the road maps anymore. The print is too small. But the GPS, you get on the wrong road, it tells you. Lets you know. Guides you back to the right one. And if you keep, just for fun, if you keep taking the wrong turn, and I've done that just for fun, because I'm a contrary person. If you keep taking the wrong turn, it never gets tired of telling you which direction is the right way. It'll keep it on forever. Finally, you just have to give up and take the right road for a change. And following Christ is like that. It's a great illustration because Jesus never worries about us making a mistake in our pursuit of him. I've made a few. I know this. More than a few, but I'm not going to tell you about all of them. Anyhow, you decide to follow Christ. He will deliver you. He will set you on a new course. You have a new destiny, a new life. You are a new person, even. You are becoming a person who is made in the image of Jesus Christ. And when I look out in front of me here, I don't see anybody here who's arrived yet. And when you're looking at me, I haven't either. But we're getting there. Following Jesus frees us to be what God always intended us to be. That's why I'm not a farmer. And that's why you won't end up being and doing some of the things that you thought either. If you're here for the first time and you decide to follow Jesus, it's not going to be what you thought it was. But I guarantee that you will never be sorry. You will never regret giving your life to Jesus. You may leave behind some things that you thought you would have liked to have had, but you won't regret it.